On Tuesday, September 10th, 2024, the Montana League of Women Voters organized a presentation by author, educator, and environmentalist Bill McKibben titled "A Desperate Moment, But an Exciting One: Can We Turn the Corner on Climate?" The lecture was presented at the Emerson Center for the Arts and Culture.
Good evening. Anybody still out in the lobby? I encourage you to come in. We're getting started promptly at 5:30, since we have a tight schedule to fit this in, and we want to make sure we have the time we've got allotted here. So, good evening, and welcome to tonight's climate lecture by Bill McKibben. My name's Nancy Leifer, and I'm president of the League of Women Voters of Montana, and I want to thank all of the organizations. Thank you. No doubt you were harassed by a few League members coming in. We'd like to make sure people know they can vote, so thank you. I want to thank all of the organizations who are co-sponsoring this event, the League of Women Voters of the Bozeman area, the Greater Yellowstone Coalition, the Gallatin Valley Community Radio, the Montana Environmental Information Center, the Montana State University Ivan Doig Center, Moms Clean Air Force, and the League of Women Voters of Montana. So thank you for all of your sponsorship. All of the co-sponsors tonight are nonpartisan or non-political organizations. All of these organizations care about the environment and consider climate change to be a serious threat to our nation and our planet. We are very pleased to have Bill McKibben speak tonight about his perspectives on the current status of climate change and the challenges we face in addressing it. Supporting and sponsoring lectures like this is an important part of the League and all of the other sponsors' missions to educate the public on issues and public policy. We hope tonight's takeaway will be ideas for actions that you can take to address climate change as an individual and actions that you can press on your government to take at the local, state, and federal level. Before we get started, I need to go over a few details about our plans for the evening. First off, let me ask that everybody make sure your cell phones are off or silenced. Secondly, our program tonight is planned to have Bozeman resident and mountaineer Conrad Anker introduce Bill McKibben, but unfortunately, he has tested positive for COVID and will not be able to be here tonight. It happens, doesn't it? Yeah. Tonight, instead, our Q&A moderator, Kathy Whitlock, will introduce Bill McKibben. Bill will then talk for approximately 30 minutes. After that, we will take questions from the audience. We ask that you submit your questions in written form on the cards that you were given coming in. And when you have a question, just wave it like this, and the League members will be coming through the audience to make sure that they can pick up those cards for you and deliver them up here to Kathy Whitlock, who will ask the questions. We want to be sure we get all the questions recorded and people can hear what they are. So that's part of the reason that we're doing it this way. We also ask that you refrain from mentioning political candidates and parties in your questions. Tonight is an educational event, and we want to focus on the issues and actions that need to be taken. We hope you enjoy tonight's lecture and encourage you to take both individual action and ask for governmental action to address climate change going forward. After the lecture, we'll be streaming the presidential debate for those of you who want to stay and watch it. As with other forums hosted by the League, this is a nonpartisan event, and we request that you refrain from cheering, booing, or applause. Instead, we encourage you to share your thoughts and reactions on the debate on social media. Thank you all for coming tonight. Now I'd like to introduce Kathy Whitlock. Dr. Kathy Whitlock is a Regents Professor Emerita of Earth Sciences at Montana State University. She was a lead author of the 2017 Montana Climate Assessment, and was the first scientist based in a Montana institution to be elected to the National Academy of Sciences. Yeah. Her research interests focus on long-term climate and environmental change, and she has spent the last 40 years studying the ecological history of the Northern Rockies, as well as comparable mountainous landscapes. Dr. Whitlock was also a witness in the recent Held versus Montana trial. So please welcome Dr. Kathy Whitlock, who will introduce Bill McKibben.
Well, good evening. Is there anyone out there who's not concerned about climate change today? With our unhealthy air, our lack of visibility, our concern for our health? Bill McKibben is founder of Third Act, which organizes people over the age of 60 for action on climate injustice. His 1989 book, The End of Nature, is regarded as the first book for a general audience about climate change and the way we relate to nature in general. For many of us, The End of Nature was and is today an inspiring call to action. No wonder it's been printed in 24 languages. Bill has gone on to write 20 more books on the state of the planet and our responsibility to fight and build a sustainable future. His work appears regularly in periodicals from The New Yorker to Rolling Stone. Bill helped found 350.org, which describes itself as an international movement of ordinary people working to end the age of fossil fuels and build a world of community-centered renewable energy. 350.org is the first global grassroots climate campaign and has organized protests for climate action on every continent, including Antarctica. He serves as a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and he has won the Gandhi Peace Prize, as well as honorary degrees from 20 colleges and universities. Bill was awarded the Right Livelihood Award, sometimes called the Alternative Nobel Prize, in the Swedish Parliament. Foreign Policy named him to its inaugural list of the world's 100 most important global thinkers. Lastly, and perhaps one of his most distinguished accolades, came in 2014 when biologists honored Bill's career by naming a new species of woodland gnat after him. Let me see if I can do this. Megothalamidia McKibbeni. It's our pleasure to welcome, for the first time to Bozeman, Montana, Bill McKibben.
Well, thank you for that
kind introduction. What a pleasure to be here. I've actually been in the beautiful city of Bozeman before a few times, but usually it was en route to go down to West Yellowstone and do some cross-country skiing. Clearly you're getting bigger all the time out here. There's more Bozeman than there used to be. Particular pleasure to get to do this under the auspices of the League of Women Voters. My sainted mother, now 94, was the chair of the League of Women Voters in our town when I was growing up, and so I monthly would take the 600 copies of the League newsletter and run them through the automatic stapler and then put stamps on them, things that are inconceivable to people now. But that was back in the olden times, okay? And I will say, in deference to the admonitions of the League, I'm, as it turns out, somewhat partisan and highly political, but I will do my best not to indicate. Maybe by the end you'll be able to guess what my politics are. As it turns out, I won't be able to stay with you for the debate because I have to go do some interviews and things during it, but it's probably just as well because I've reached some point in my, I'm old enough that I don't think I have the self-control anymore to refrain from either booing or cheering during the, so the closest thing I will make to a political remark maybe is just to say that for the next 60 days, Montanans are endowed with superpowers. You guys are literally going to decide who has control of the United States Senate, and hence control of what America can or can't do in regard to the issues that we are discussing. And there's not very many of you. I mean, I come from a smaller state than Montana, so I have some sense, but and our state is, Vermont has done its job, I must say. But you guys have unbelievable, you're 100 times the size of anybody else in the world right now. All those superpowers will completely evaporate on November 6th. So use them wisely in the meantime would be my advice. Okay. Now, it's a great pleasure for me to be here, but it's probably more of a pleasure for me than it will be for you, because it must be said that some part of my job in the world for many decades is just to be a professional bummer-outer of people. And we are going to do some of that, but then we're going to try and get to a somewhat better place. And if I seem a little tired and weary, and I may sit down at some point, it's because I've been on a breakneck schedule across Big Sky Country. The night before last, I was at Montana State in Billings, which was great fun. And then last night, I was up at, Paul, where were we? About 40 minutes outside of town at a place called Hard Scrabble Ranch with many of the country's greatest athletes for this summit of this wonderful group called Protect Our Winters. And I talked there last night, and then this morning I got to interview on stage three remarkable young women from Montana who were the among the defendants in this incredibly important Held v. Montana case, which was really exciting. And now I get to be with you, and then I have to leave first thing tomorrow morning. I'm on a sort of endless tour of the swing states of America until November 5th. So I'm doing my best, just like I'm encouraging you to. So let's talk about why all this is so important. I wrote the first book about climate change, as Margaret said, back in 1989. Back then, this was a warning. We were transmitting what the scientists told us with some confidence was going to happen if we kept burning coal and gas and oil, that the planet was going to heat up and that it was going to be dangerous. Those warnings were not really heeded. Human beings have produced more carbon dioxide since 1989 than in all of human history before 1989. So you could say, I suppose, that this was one of the least successful books ever written. But it was accurate. The things that scientists were warning us about then are now coming true. And they're coming true in dramatic, painful, horrifying fashion. And they're coming true right now. The planet's been steadily warming, but in the last 18 months, it's taken a kind of step change, a kind of jump to the next level of what's going on. Beginning in about January of 2023, I started hearing from oceanographer friends around the world saying something's happening with the temperature of the ocean. It had been steadily increasing for decades, but all of a sudden it was starting to spike, spiking so hard that by June of 2023, we saw the highest temperatures ever recorded in the planet's oceans. The buoys off the Florida Keys were reporting temperatures of 101 degrees Fahrenheit in the sea, which is what you turn your hot tub to, okay? By June, that was fully moving on to land. We have enough thermometers in satellites, in buoys, in weather stations around the world that we can take every day an average temperature for the Earth. Okay? And the temperature is always highest every year around the solstice in the northern hemisphere, because there's more land mass in the northern hemisphere to absorb more of the sun's heat. And last year, June 2023, the scientists were telling us, watching those data sets, that we were living through the hottest days that we have ever recorded on this Earth. Now, our records only go back 200 years. That's when thermometers were invented. But scientists are good at developing proxy records, tree rings, ocean sediments, to allow us to stretch that much further back. And they were saying with confidence that it was hotter than it had been in the last 125,000 years on this planet. The solstice, the weeks around the solstice this summer on this planet were hotter still. We've broken those records. So we are living on a hotter planet than any human beings that we would sort of recognize as human beings have really ever lived on. 125,000 years ago was about the point, the anthropologists tell us, when people began to etch symbols onto bone. Okay, it goes back about as far as human culture goes back. Some of the danger that comes with that, some of the peril, is expressed just in the form of sheer heat. We see heat waves now on a scale that people have never experienced, and they are unbelievably debilitating. Big parts of Asia, including some of the biggest cities in the world, in the last couple of years have had extended heat waves where the temperature was constantly flirting with 120 degrees. In the Middle East this summer, there were places, cities, where not only was the temperature so high, but the humidity so high that the feels-like temperature, the heat index, was approximately 150 degrees Fahrenheit. These are at the absolute outer edge of the ability of the human body to survive. Past a certain point, sweat won't evaporate. You can't cool yourself. But those temperatures are also setting off huge changes in the world around us. The ice at both poles is now melting and melting fast. The disturbing news from the last few months is that it's becoming pretty clear that the biggest glaciers in the Antarctic are being so efficiently undercut by warm water in the Southern Ocean that they're now greasing their slide. And that represents the possibility of feet, maybe meters of sea level rise in the course of this century. On land, we see most dramatically what happens in the way that water moves around the Earth, the hydrological properties of our planet. If you wanted one way, one thing, fact to understand this century, you could do a lot worse than warm air holds more water vapor than cold. Okay. In arid areas, we get lots more evaporation, and then we get drought as a result. And then as night follows day, that combination of drought and heat produces fire, which is why you can, we were coming up the valley this morning, and we couldn't hardly see. Sacagawea was a kind of, faint smudge in the horizon. Right now, today in California, have in your hearts the people, there's a huge fire out of control threatening 35,000 homes. You guys have some ideas what this is like from the big fires that swept up through Bridger Pass there a couple of years ago. Once that water's up in the air, it's going to come down. And it comes down in deluge and flood, in rainstorms the likes of which we've never seen. Vermont, where I live, has had its two biggest rainstorms ever in the last 2 years, and they have been utterly devastating. Our capital city was submerged. Many of the businesses are still closed because they were just filled with mud. But Montana and Vermont and California remain rich enough, at least for the moment, that we have some sort of resilience from some of this. We can rebuild roads and bridges and resettle people and so on. That's not true in much of the rest of the world. Just to give you an example, When the rain stopped last year in Vermont, within days, the record rainfall was coming in the north of Africa, and it was truly intense. There's another one of these flood systems underway there now. But last year, the rainfall was so high that in Libya, in North Africa, a rampaging river wiped out two dams in a row and then swept into a big coastal city and washed 10,000 people out to sea where they drowned in the course of an afternoon. That kind of thing happens with some regularity in much of the world now. And the thing that gives it a kind of moral sting is that nobody in those places did anything at all to cause the problem from which they are now suffering. All of Africa, the entire continent, the biggest continent on Earth, produced 3% of all the greenhouse gases that are up in the air. The U.S., which has 3% of the world's people, has produced 25% of those greenhouse gases. No one, not even China, is going to catch up with us as historic contributor to this. And it's all still up there. The stuff that came out of the tailpipe of my family's maroon Plymouth Fury in 1974 when I was getting my learner's permit is still up there in the atmosphere trapping heat. Okay? So this is the deepest practical problem that humans have ever faced and the deepest sort of moral and justice problem that humans have ever faced. And the scary part is that we're nearer the beginning of it than the end. So far, we've raised the temperature just about 1.5 degrees Celsius, 2.8 degrees Fahrenheit, something like that. And that's caused the chaos that we have seen so far. That was enough to fundamentally unbalance things. But we're on a trajectory right now that unless we intervene very quickly, will take us in the lifetimes of the younger people in this room to something like 3 degrees Celsius, 5 degrees Fahrenheit. If that happens, we will not have civilizations like the ones we're used to having. That's just too much violent chaos and flux. If nothing else, the UN estimates that that's enough to produce somewhere between 1 billion and 3 billion climate refugees on this planet. Okay, people who have to leave their homes because their homes are now underwater or in a desert or have burned down. You saw what happened to our politics when 1 million refugees showed up at our southern border. Saw what happened to European politics when 1 million refugees from the Syrian civil war, itself caused in large part by drought, showed up on the borders of Europe. I'm afraid we'll hear some of that ugliness radiating out from tonight's debate. Now multiply that by 1,000 or 3,000 times and imagine what kind of world we live in. The biggest job that humans have ever had is the job now before us of preventing as much of that as we can. Not stopping global warming, it is too late for that, but stopping it from short of the point where it cuts civilization off at the knees. And we're not certain we can do that still. And if we can, we know very good and well that we have to do it fast. And if there's one thing I want to leave with you, it's that idea of how quickly we need to move. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the world's climate scientists, put out a paper in 2021 that gave us the math. They said if we wanted to have a hope of staying on those targets that we set in Paris, then we would need to cut emissions in half by 2030, which by my watch is 5 years and 4 months away. Okay? Which might give you some clue why the next presidential term will be an important one. Okay? That is the biggest task we've ever had. And if we get it wrong, then it's not like other political questions that we face. It's not like national health insurance or something where we should do the right thing, but maybe eventually we will. And if we do, our delay won't make it harder. Climate change isn't like that. Once you've melted the Arctic, nobody has a plan for how you freeze it back up again. So this is the place that we are at. All right. We're through the hard part. I'm going to take a breath. You can take a breath, and then we will proceed. And we'll proceed in a slightly happier vein, because we have a pretty good idea now what we need to do if we want to avert the worst, all right? In a way that we didn't even a few years ago. And the reason we have an idea is mostly because the engineers have really done their job. Scientists did their job 35 years ago. They gave us their warning of what was to come. The engineers have done their job in the last decade because they've dropped the price of clean energy so fast and so far. Energy from the sun and the wind and the batteries to store that energy when the sun goes down or the wind drops, the price of those things has fallen 90% in the last decade. Sometime in the last 3 or 4 years, we passed some invisible line where they became cheaper than coal and gas and oil. We now live on a planet where the cheapest way to produce energy is to point a sheet of glass at the sun. Okay, that is a miracle. That is a water into wine miracle, all right? It means that there's not a financial or technological obstacle to doing what we must do. I don't think we've yet internalized that fact completely. I think we still think of sun and wind as alternative energy, sort of as if it was the kind of Whole Foods event. Do you guys have Whole Foods here? There's like the Whole Foods of energy. It's not. It's the Costco of energy, okay? It is the cheap stuff available in bulk, ready to go, all right? And in the few places that we have really profoundly managed to deploy it, we can see what's happening. California, bedeviled by those fires, has made a better effort than pretty much any place else to deploy this stuff over the last 3 or 4 years. And it's been increasing 20-30% a year for the last few years. And finally, this year, that means that it's reached a level where, wow. For the last 100 days in California, they've produced more than 100% of the electricity they use for many hours each day from renewable energy. Okay? At night, when the sun goes down, the biggest source of supply on the grid in California are huge batteries, none of which were there 3 or 4 years ago. This is how fast this is happening. What does that mean in real terms? It means that compared to last year, California in 2024 is using 29% less gas to produce electricity. That's a big number. That's a number large enough to start to put a dent in that 3 degrees Celsius, all right? And that's the fifth largest economy in the world and arguably the most modern. It is remarkable to see. And it's not just California. In the last few months, Texas has passed California, who's deploying the most batteries, putting up the most wind turbines, so on and so forth, which might be a salutary lesson since Texas is a oil and gas state too, but they have managed to get it together to do some pretty remarkable things. What that means, and let me just sort of be lyrical here for a moment, what that means is that human beings are actually in reach of a kind of massive leap up the human, up the kind of evolutionary a huge evolutionary change. The earliest evidence we really have of human beings dates back about 700,000 years, and it's a fire. It's a hearth someplace with some charcoal on it, okay? Darwin said that fire and language were the two things that set human beings apart. Fire's been good to us. When we learned to set fires, we could cook food, and that gave us the big brain. We could move north and south from the equator. Nobody was living in Bozeman before the invention of fire. The anthropologists think that standing around the campfire every night forever accounts for some of the social bonds that mark our species. It was a kind of proto-Zoom, you know. And then when we learned to control the combustion of coal and gas and oil in the Industrial Revolution, that gave us modernity. Everything around us, the world that we understand. But the price of that burning, that combustion, is now too high. It is the destruction of the planet through climate change, and in the meantime, it is the death of 9 million people a year, about one death in five, that comes from breathing the particulates that are produced when you burn coal and gas and oil. If you've been to Delhi or Shanghai in recent years, you'll know what I'm talking about, but it happens here too. There are hundreds of thousands of cases of childhood asthma in America every year caused by breathing those particulates, and we know who gets to live next to the highway and next to the refinery. It's another reason why this is a profound justice issue. So it is remarkable to imagine that we live at the moment when we could stop burning stuff, all right? We can kill the fire under the hood of your car. You don't need a spark plug because now we have an EV, then or an e-bike, and they'll do what's needed without any fire. We can turn off the fire in your basement. You don't need a furnace because we have electric heat pumps now that do the job better and cheaper. You can turn off the fire in your kitchen because an induction cooktop, $60 from Amazon. I'm the cook in our house, and this is the best stuff in the world. I can't explain exactly how it works, magnets somehow, but I can tell you that it does the job, all right? We can definitely turn off the fire at those big coal-fired and gas-fired power plants because the good Lord was kind enough to hang a large ball of burning gas 93 million miles away, and now we have the wit to make full use of it. We can catch its rays on those photovoltaic panels, and we can take advantage of the fact that it differentially heats the earth, producing the wind that turns those turbines. We could stop burning stuff. And that's amazing. That could be, suffice it to say, that's amazing. So, biggest problem the world has ever faced, large solution at hand. The question really is why we aren't going all out pell-mell to put that solution in place everywhere. For example, why did I drive past on the way here from Billings, a huge new gas-fired power plant in the town of Laurel that's supposed to go on in a few weeks? What were they thinking? The answer to that question really rests in the fact that there are powerful forces in our civilization that do not want us to make this transition. And they're not hard to identify. They're the forces that own coal mines and oil wells and gas fields, because those become largely valueless the day that we decide that we're going to use the sun instead. We know now that the oil industry has spent the last 30 years spreading disinformation. We know from great investigative reporting that they, back in the 1980s when I was writing that book of mine, they were studying the same thing, and they had great scientists. Exxon was the biggest company in the world, had a huge staff of scientists. Their product was carbon. Of course they were going to find out what was going on, and they did. We know from their archives that their scientists told their executives with stunning accuracy what the temperature was going to be in 2020. And the executives believed them. Exxon, in the 1980s, began building all its drilling rigs higher to compensate for the rise in sea level that they knew was coming. Okay? What they didn't do, of course, was tell the rest of us. Instead, across this industry, they invested billions of dollars to build this architecture of deceit and denial and disinformation that kept us locked for 30 years in a completely sterile debate about whether or not global warming was real. A debate, remember, that both sides knew the answer to at the start, it's just one of them was willing to lie. And that lie turns out to be the most consequential lie in human history because it cost us the one thing we could least afford, which was time. That's why we have 5 years to do this, not 35 years, okay? We've reached the point now where it's very difficult to be a climate denier with a straight face, though it's possible you'll see the attempt made at tonight's debate. There have been too many fires and too many floods, but they've moved on to what you might call solutions denial, to saying, oh, yes, it's a good thing that we'll have solar power, but it'll take decades to get there. We have a slow transition. It's not ready yet, on and on and on and on. None of which is any truer than their climate denial was, but it remains politically potent, as people in Montana, I think, know, which means that we have to build movements to try and counter that. And that's where I'm going to end this talk. Took me a while to figure that out. I was 27 when I wrote The End of Nature. And my theory of change in those days was people will read my book and then they will change. And a lot of people did read it. I mean, it came out in 24 languages or something. But it turns out that's not actually how things happen. I wrote a bunch more books and things for a while because I, being a good, you know, writer and academic, was convinced that if we won the argument, why wouldn't our leaders do the right thing? But it turns out that you can win the argument, which we had won by the middle of the 1990s. The science was absolutely clear and in consensus. You can win the argument, but you still lose the fight because the fight wasn't about data and reason and evidence. It was about what fights are always about, which is money and power. And the fossil fuel industry had so much money and hence so much power that they could lose the argument and just keep their business model ticking merrily along. Okay. So we had to start building movements. We had to start doing really what the League of Women Voters tells us to do, to become civically engaged to do that kind of work. The one that first effort that we made was this thing called 350.org, which took its odd name from what the scientists told us was the most carbon we could safely have in the atmosphere. 350 parts per million, a number we already then were well past. We're at about 420 parts per million now, which is why the Arctic is melting. When we started 350.org, it was myself and seven college students, and we had no idea what we were doing, and we had no money. But we decided to organize the world. There were seven students. There are seven continents. Each one took one. The one that took the Antarctic had to take the internet also. Okay, and in 2009 we had really what amounted to a kind of coming out party for the global climate movement, a day of action with 5,200 demonstrations in 181 countries, including a couple of really good ones in Montana. And since then, 350.org, which has a great chapter here in Big Sky Country, has gone on to organize about 20,000 demonstrations in every country on Earth except North Korea. And we started a bunch of fights, including the fight over the Keystone Pipeline, which became one of the big, maybe the big climate battle of the last decade. And then we started this fossil fuel divestment campaign to get institutions to sell their stock in coal and gas and oil, and that's become the biggest campaign of its kind in history. We're at about $40 trillion now in endowments and portfolios that have divested. That was all good, The best result was how quickly so many other people took up this work. Consider that divestment campaign. A lot of it happened on college campuses. And so the kids on those college campuses got good at this kind of thing. And when they graduated, they formed this thing called the Sunrise Movement because they wanted to keep on working. And the Sunrise Movement, there's a couple of young women from the Sunrise Movement out there someplace. Stand up if you're there so we can say hi. Well, they brought us the Green New Deal, and the Green New Deal, once it had been run through the congressional sausage-making machinery, brought us the Inflation Reduction Act, which was the first thing that Congress ever did to try and do something about this. And that was amazing. And it wouldn't have happened without those young people. And of course, there were lots of other young people. You all know Greta Thunberg. She's one of my favorite people to work with in the whole world. I got to write her, check this out, a letter last summer congratulating her on her graduation from high school. you know, there you go. She'd be the first to say there are 10,000 Greta Thunbergs around the world, and they have 10 million followers. That's how many high school kids were out on climate strike in September of 2019 before the pandemic hit. So young people are doing their job. And the young people in here are doing a great job, and I just had a terrific meeting with a bunch of them beforehand, and they're working hard to do things like get the Bozeman schools to start putting up many more solar panels and things like that. So back them up, help them, find them at the high school and at the university, okay, because they're doing good and important things. The only problem with all that great youth activity is that a few too many people my age, I heard saying some variant on, oh, it's up to the next generation to solve this problem, okay? And if they really wanted to rub some salt in that wound, they would stare fondly at some young people and say, you give me hope. Which is really, if you think about it, not particularly fair. Okay, it's not quite right to take the deepest problem the world has ever encountered and say, why don't you deal with this after field hockey practice, you know? It's not only not fair, it's not practical, because for all their intelligence and idealism and energy, young people lack the structural power by themselves to make the change that we need in the time that we have. Remember, we have 5 years, so Greta Thunberg is not going to grow up and be the prime minister of Sweden in the course of 5 years. All right? So I began to be haunted by this idea and start to wonder about where we might find some of that structural power able to get this done. And that's why a couple of years ago we started this thing called Third Act in this country, and it's only for people over the age of 60. I can't see you all out there because of the lights, but I suspect there are three or four people here who fall inside that demographic envelope, and the rest of you just tell your grandparents about this, okay? The reason I wanted to is because if you're looking for structural power, well, I was telling people last night at this gathering, I said, if you've reached the age where you have hair coming out your ears, then you have structural power coming out your ears as well. There are 70 million Americans over the age of 60. We punch above our weight politically because we all vote. There's no known way to stop old people from voting, okay? And we ended up with most of the country's financial assets. So if you wanted to put some pressure on Helena or on Washington or on Wall Street, all of which I would like to do, then it helps to have some people with hairlines like mine engaged in this fight. People used to say when we started that this probably wouldn't work because people get more conservative as they age. which may have been true once upon a time, but if you think about it, people who are in their third act now, in their 60s, 70s, or 80s, their first act was in that period of incredible social and cultural and political transformation. The apex of the civil rights movement, the moment when we started taking women seriously in public life, the first Earth Day, when 20 million Americans went into the streets, the biggest demonstration in American history, that was 10% of the then population. It brought us the EPA, the Endangered Species Act, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act. In Montana, within a couple of years, it bought you that green amendment to the state constitution under which Held v. Montana was pursued. Okay. So those are the people who now constitute, you know, much of the country's aging population. And what do you know? We still can do this stuff. We can do it in electoral terms. I think the League would be very proud of our, right at the moment, we've got third actors. There's about 80,000 people now who volunteer with this, and there's working groups in many of the states in the country and things, and we're producing about 200,000 letters a week, postcards a week into the swing states, and phone banking almost every night. And now there's busloads of old people descending on these swing states to knock on doors, because you know what? Americans will still open their door if there's like a 75-year-old lady on the other side, okay? And so we're doing that, but we're also, you know, we're feisty too. We've been taking on the big banks that Chase, Citi, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, that are the biggest funders of the fossil fuel industry, that continue to give these guys billions of dollars, even though all the scientific authorities have said, stop doing that. We can't keep building new fossil fuel infrastructure. They keep doing it. So we've been outside their doors trying to close them down. Last spring, we had simultaneous demonstrations in 100 cities across the country. I was in Washington, where we had thousands of people, and we wanted to sit in outside these banks and close them down for the day, but we've reached the age when the prospect of sprawling on the sidewalk for 3 or 4 hours is somewhat less appealing than once it might have been. And so we went to the Goodwill stores in the area and found every rocking chair that they had. And that's what we used to shut those down. The New York Times the next day called it the Rocking Chair Rebellion. Young people, know that there are increasingly others who have your back here, who are not abandoning you to this work. And I trust that everyone here will make that true in Bozeman, as in many other places. And I trust, too, that we will figure out how to really push now in these next couple of years. The planet is way outside its comfort zone, so it's time for us to be outside ours some, too, whatever that means. One thing I hope it means is that we're beginning the planning. I'm not sure we can pull it off, but I think we can, for a big global day of action, kind of like that first Earth Day, next solstice on this planet, next June. We're planning to call it, check this out, Sun Day. And we're going to do it to kind of celebrate this idea. I mean, imagine people marching and concerts and festivals. And I was talking with all these athletes last night, who include some of the world's greatest climbers like Conrad Anker. I said, we need you guys ropes out, you know, figuring out what buildings you can climb to do some guerrilla installations of solar panels up high, you know, and things like that. Imagine for a day just people focused on, because I was talking with kids earlier today. I think we've maxed out the number of people we can mobilize with fear and anger and guilt and sadness. Those are appropriate emotions, and we've used them as best we can. But we also need some joy and adventure and romance in this fight. We need something akin to the kind of spirit underneath the moonshot in the 1960s. That was an interesting technological project, but it involved putting two people on a different planet. This one involves bringing a different planet down to ours and using it to make it possible to maintain the incredible beauty of the Earth that we were born onto. So it seems like a reasonable thing to at least try to really push, to kind of change the zeitgeist so that everybody understands that this is a possibility. Now, I'm going to end here because I've rattled on for a long time, but I can't guarantee you that if we do this, it will work, any of this. There's some chance that we've waited too long to get started. The forces in motion around the world are very big and very scary. It is unsettling to read the latest scientific accounts of how the great currents of the Atlantic, for instance, may be within a decade of faltering and shutting down. But the best science indicates we have a narrow, rapidly closing window still to operate, and so we should. And we should do it together. Americans have a strong default towards individualism. It's good and bad, part of our national character, you know? But it means that when we confront a problem like climate change, really one of the first things we ask ourselves is, you know, what's on my roof, what's in my garage? Not a bad question. And I'm very happy that my roof is covered with solar panels and that they connect to an EV in the garage and things. But we are past the point where we are solving this problem one Tesla at a time, all right? The most important thing that an individual can do is be less of an individual and join together with others in movements large enough to change the ground rules here. That means for the next 50-some days, being deeply engaged in electoral work, especially here where you guys have those superpowers. And it means going forward, aligning yourselves with others, building the organizations, doing the work that really makes this change happen. No guarantees. Dr. King, my hero, used to end his speeches by saying, "The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice." That was comforting. It meant this may take a while, but we're going to win, which was a message that the very brave people in the civil rights movement needed to hear. But that's not our message. The arc of the physical universe is short, and it bends toward heat. If we don't win soon, we don't win. But the good news about that is that everybody in this room will live long enough to see the outcome of this fight. It's, in the end, a test, I think, of whether or not that big brain that we got from eating that meat that we cooked over the fire, whether or not that big brain was a good adaptation or not. Got us in some trouble. Now we'll find if it gets us out. My intuition is that the real answer to that question depends on the size of the heart that the brain is attached to. And I am counting on all of you to have big hearts enough to get done all that you can in the time that we have. Thank you. Thank you all very much, very much. Did I leave any time for? Okay, good. All right, I'm going to go, since I'm worn out, I'm going to assume the hot seat here. And you can fire questions or comments or abuse or whatever you would like at me, and I will do my best.
Well, thank you for those, you know, just that powerful message and inspiration. And I want to, we're waiting for questions, and so I thought I'd start with my own. I've done a lot of work talking about climate change in Montana, and Montana's experienced climate change, of course, like the rest of the planet. And most people believe that the climate is changing and that it's going to impact the next generations. But polls suggest that less than 40% think that it's going to impact them personally. And that really bothers me, because I think that there's a gap between recognizing a problem but failing to take action. And I've wondered if it's not partly driven by the fact that we're a pretty good place. Montana's a pretty good place. We've been pretty lucky. We haven't experienced any of the, you know, the big disasters or the economic losses that other places have with climate change. And so with the election coming up, I'm just wondering, you know, how do we elevate this climate issue to a basically disinterested and sort of unmotivated electorate on this particular topic?
Well, first of all, let me just say, the idea that you've experienced none of this is, as you know, look, as you walk outside today, take note of the fact that big sky country is actually, you know, gray haze country at the moment.
Yeah.
You're sucking down, a pack of cigarettes in the course of going about your day's business today because the air is filled with smoke. But also, think about the sort of way that people are convinced that it will affect the next generations. That should be more than enough to get people to be concerned about. What's the point of political life except to try and protect the next generations? But look, so getting people concerned about climate change is really important. But there's another way, as I was suggesting, to go at this too, and that's to keep pointing out the spectacular waste of, you know, just start trying to calculate how much sunlight and how much wind Montana wastes every single day. You know, and try to figure out how much money you're going to pay. It really drove me nuts to drive past that new gas plant in Laurel on the way here, because you're being played for suckers. The places around the world that are on the technological cutting edge aren't doing this anymore. 90% of the new generation that's gone online in America this year has been renewable. Almost none has been coal and gas, because everyone else has figured out that this is the most expensive way that there is to generate energy going forward. And my safe prediction is your electric rates are going to be going up in Montana for the next while as you try to. The 10 of the 11 states with the highest renewable penetration in America are also the 10 states with the lowest electric rates in America. So, maybe there's more than one way to skin this particular cat.
Thank you. So I have a stack of questions so I'm just going to go through some of them. I've been hearing since the IRA that permitting reform is needed to build the renewable energy that's now so cheap. I'm dismayed environmentalists haven't supported the current permitting reform bill. Could you make a case for that bill?
There's a current plan sponsored by Senator Manchin and Senator Barrasso for permitting reform. It might be a clue that those two senators are also the senators who've taken more money from the fossil fuel industry than almost anybody else in Washington, because this permitting reform is coupled with a series of really outlandish gifts to the fossil fuel industry, the most important of which would be an end to President Biden's pause on the construction of new export terminals for liquefied natural gas out of the Gulf of Mexico. This sounds like a small thing. It is not a small thing. The natural gas in the Permian Basin of America is the biggest greenhouse bomb left on the planet. If they keep increasing at the rate that the industry wants, the export of natural gas out of this country, within 5 years, exported American natural gas will be producing more greenhouse gas emissions than everything that happens on the continent of Europe. Every car, factory, and home from Helsinki to Athens will be doing less damage than exporting natural gas out of the United States. So it's important to get permitting reform so we can build transmission lines, but it's dumb to do it at the cost of making the climate problem deeply worse in the rest of the world. Because remember, this is not one of these problems that you can solve in one country at a time. They don't call it global warming for nothing, okay?
Yeah, for sure. Thank you. What do you think is the biggest barrier to the climate justice movement reaching the scale of previous massive social movements?
Well, I mean, in some ways, it's reached that scale. I mean, we've mobilized tens of millions of people around the world. But this is different than other fights because it comes with a built-in and very well-endowed enemy who very much wants to prevent it from happening. And, you know, all movements are hard, all change is hard, but if there'd been someone who said, say, if there was an industry that, say, stood to make trillions of dollars by discriminating against gay people, then the gay rights movement would have been even harder than it is, than it has been, you know? So there's reasons why this fight is hard. But that's the reason that we need everybody engaged in it. I'm always impressed by the fact that when we manage to really fight on something, there's a pretty good chance that we will win. We've beaten a bunch of these pipelines. We got this big pause on LNG exports last year. We don't win every fight, but we win an increasing number of them if we actually go to work. And some of them are fights against things, but some of them are fights for things. You know, the fights for solar power in the schools in Bozeman that the kids are, you know, contemplating now. Those are good, useful things that you should be able to chalk up pretty quickly, you know, and go on.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there'll ever be a time for geoengineering? Do you think it's a Pandora's box?
So geoengineering is the idea that you would, that having filled the atmosphere with one chemical to deleterious effect, carbon dioxide, we would now also fill the atmosphere with sulfur, because that would then block some of the incoming sunlight and keep things cooler. Obviously, it's not it would not be your first choice for how to do this, all right? It's possible that we've let things go so far that this kind of break the glass solution is something that may someday have to do, and we should be studying how to do it now, I think. But it's the last possible resort. And we don't really need strange, dangerous technology like that because we have available to us this incredibly straightforward and cheap technology that is solar panels. Instead of trying to blot out the sun with sulfur, we need to be capturing the sun with photovoltaic panels so we can turn off the coal and gas and oil.
And so many of those geoengineering solutions are things we have to do forever.
Right. Well, if you're interested, I've tried to write some about this over the years, and it's a series of bad technological ideas. But as I say, if we don't take the actions that we can take now, then we will try it at some point because we'll have no choice. It will just be too, I don't know if people have read Though maybe a few people have read Kim Stanley Robinson's remarkable novel, Ministry for the Future, which is really the best piece of fiction about climate change that there's yet been. And it begins with a heat wave in India so severe that it kills millions of people, at which point the Indian government begins a kind of geoengineering program. We're not far off from that. It was 120 degrees for day after day after day in Delhi this year. Delhi's the second largest city in the world. It's 35 million people. These are not people who have air conditioners. These are people who live in the hardest possible conditions. At a certain point, we'll reach a breaking point. And part of our job is to move fast enough that we don't, I think.
Right, right. I want to ask you a couple questions about the environment. So we are in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem, which is, it's about the size of Maine, and it's the last large, intact, pristine ecosystem in the temperate latitudes. And right now there's a debate, I would say, in the environmental community as to future management of the ecosystem. So on the one hand, you provide more access to sort of recreational users into the wilderness so that they can appreciate nature and realize how important this place is. And the other, you set aside more wilderness to protect for wildlife. And there's really, we're sort of at a crossroads as to where we put the emphasis, or do we divide it in half and do both? I just wondered what your thoughts were on that kind of thing.
It's very good. It's one of the most important things for human beings is to realize when they have questions that are above their pay grade. The Yellowstone ecosystem is fantastic, and doing the things we can, say, to build those big connections, the Yellowstone to Yukon kind of projects and things, are absolutely crucial. But it's also absolutely crucial to have people able to fall in love with the world around them. People who fall in love with the world around them are the ones who come to protect that world. But it is also good to remember that there are other... I was talking last night with the athletes at this gathering at Protect Our Winters, and I was teasing them for their Western chauvinism. I'm a great partisan of the mountains of the American East, and I've spent most of my life in the Adirondack Park State Park of New York, which is actually bigger than Yellowstone Park, Yosemite Park, Glacier Park, and Yosemite Park combined. So it is good to remember that there are other places, too, that have some beautiful, intact nature around them. Don't feel the weight of the entire world on your shoulders here going forward.
But in Montana, there's a lot of concern for the loss of open land for wildlife and ecosystems. And how would you address those concerns in terms of loss of land for solar and wind?
Well, we don't need to take all the land for solar and wind. We need to take a very small amount. Mark Jacobson at Stanford has a good piece today pointing out that we would be using, if we ran this country entirely on sun and wind, it would take up far less land than we're currently using for oil and gas drilling and for growing corn to produce ethanol. And even much of that land is completely useful for all sorts of things. I had a piece in the New Yorker on Saturday about a very pleasant day that I spent in the solar fields of Vermont a couple of weeks ago with some people who've made it their business to plant those solar fields with pollinator-friendly native plants, and they've been, it's the numbers of pollinating insects that now the increase is just truly astonishing. So done right, much of this could be a big boon for the natural world. Just to give you an idea, I'm talking here less about Montana than about the country as a whole, but just to give you an idea of the efficiency of solar panels. I was in Illinois the other day, and with some guys who were developing solar fields. And Illinois, as you know, is mostly corn, And about 60% of that corn is used for ethanol. So this guy was driving a Ford F-150 Lightning, the EV version of the most popular vehicle in the world. I imagine there's a few Ford F-150s patrolling the streets of Bozeman at any given moment. He said, so if you take an acre of corn and you grow it and produce ethanol, that's enough to drive a Ford F-150 about 25,000 miles. So not, you know, insignificant. But if you take that same field of corn and put solar panels in it, maybe with some pollinator-friendly native plants between the rows, and you take the electricity that that acre produces in a year, and you put it in an electric version of the Ford F-150, instead of getting 25,000 miles, you get 550,000 miles. Okay? Photosynthesis is a remarkable trick that nature has figured out, but it's not an especially efficient one. A solar panel is much more efficient in taking the, you know, and so, I mean, the beauty of all of this is that the sun that already provides us with heat and light and photosynthesis would now be quite happy to provide us with all the power that we could possibly want, you know, and that would be a good thing.
Let me give you two more questions. What has your study of climate change shown you about human psychology?
Well, I mean, that's that big brain question, really. You know, look, there's plenty to chastise ourselves for. Humans can be selfish and short-sighted and, on and on. But humans also have some record of rising to the occasion when pushed against the, when sort of pushed to action. And it's been, for me, extraordinarily beautiful in these last years to watch the rise of this movement all over the world. And to see the people willing to go outside their comfort zone, whatever that meant. Sometimes it's meant, I mean, you know, I've ended up in jail half a dozen times, I guess, by now. That's not what everybody needs to do, but it is nice always to be there with lots of other people who have decided that they're willing to put themselves out, you know, and the same in so many other ways. So I still like our species, more or less, I hold out some hope for the things that we might do in the next few years. But you can ask me again in 5 years, you know, when we've come up against that deadline, and I might have a different answer.
Well, so your last question is: if you could tell young people just one thing tonight that they might do to help the climate crisis, what is it?
Young people are doing it already. So I would tell them to remind their parents and grandparents that they better pitch in too, you know, would be what I would say. Kids know what they're staring down the barrel of. I'll tell you, we did the first demonstration we did at Third Act, a bunch of young people from Fridays for the Future, the sort of American part of Greta's school strike movement, called up and said, we want to take on these big banks, you know. But, you know, we don't even have, like, checking accounts. They won't give us credit cards and stuff, so will you come help? And we were like, sure. So we had a big demonstration outside one of these banks in Boston, I think the first one was. And there were 200 or 300 high school kids, because high school kids completely get what's going on, you know. And the high school kids were also somewhat spryer, so they were at the head of the march. But at the back of the march, there was a big bunch of us from this nascent Third Act with a large banner that said, fossils against fossil fuels, okay? So that would be what I think that's what kids should say, you know, hey, you fossils, get on board. So thank you all enormously. What pleasure to have been here. Thank you, friend.
That was fantastic.
Good stuff.
That was Bill McKibben speaking at the Emerson Center for the Arts and Culture on Tuesday, September 10th, 2024, in a presentation organized by the Montana League of Women Voters.